Good evening, everyone. I'm going to call to order the second work group of the High School Redesign Committee. And I think we should go around and introduce ourselves since we have a couple of guests here today. And please identify yourself and your role here tonight. Go ahead and start, Representative Swales.
I'm Representative Swales and I represent Woodbury and Landfall.
And would you tell us what you do for a living?
I'm an AP English teacher at Woodbury High School.
Thank you.
I'm Representative Brown and I am a teacher at Albert Lee High School. I teach art.
I'm Representative John Bosey, represent Minnetonka, Plymouth, and was an AP teacher for 37 years in Regina Schools.
And I'm Representative Tom Tilbury, and I represent 51B, which is Fridley, Spring Lake Park, Moundsview, and a portion of Blaine. And I'm a high school counselor at Rose Valeria School.
Representative Bunn.
Hi, I'm Representative Julie Bunn, and I'm not a teacher or a counselor, but I've been to school. No, my mother was a teacher. I am just interested generally in the issue of high school reform, particularly the areas of science and technology and math curriculum.
Ms. Larson, would you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Lisa Larson, and I work for House Research.
And to my left, we have Elizabeth Mandelman, and she is here taking notes tonight. And just as a reminder to everyone, this is a work group, so we will not be taking any action, but the session is recorded. For those of you in the audience, I hate to do this to you, but we're going to just spend a couple of minutes talking about a book that I sent out to all the members. And the reason is because I used to be a teacher, and I do know that you never hand out homework assignments without checking up to see if they did the homework, because, well, that just has bad results. So we have all read the book, Who Moved My Cheese for Teens. And we picked this book, first of all, because it's easy to read. I thought if I was going to give an assignment, I still wanted everybody to like me afterwards. Mm-hmm. So it was quick. And the other thing is, it was for teens. And since we are talking about high school redesign, I thought it was appropriate to read a book that is at the high school level. And for those of you who have not read the book, there are four characters in the book. There are two mice and two humans.
Humanoids.
Small people. And I don't have my book here tonight. I left it on the counter. But the two mice were Sniff and
Scurry.
And then the humanoids were Him and Haw. We're not going to talk about the characters too much tonight because that can get into quite a lengthy discussion. I really want to break right to the cheese. The theme of that book is the cheese moving throughout the maze, and the mice being having each their own individual reaction to this cheese being moved. Well, we're talking about high school redesign. And in the context of high school redesign, I'd like us all to think about, what is the cheese in high school redesign? And how has it moved? Now, we have all these teachers here. I would at least hope that you will all have something to say about that. That provocative question I've just posed.
I'll try.
Okay.
For me, the cheese is that we have a model of an educational model that is still grounded very much in 19th century practices. And for many people in the field of education, that has remained somewhat sacred. And it's difficult to move to a new model. It's difficult to change how we've always done it. And there's a lot of systemic reasons for that. A lot of it has to do with the way teachers are compensated. A lot of it has to do with expectations by parents about, you know, what they consider traditional education. So I think it's changing the culture. I think it's trying to help people realize that the current model could be changed so that it is more appropriate, more relevant, more meaningful to not only to students and their families, but to our economy and to the future. Thank you.
I was going to say, I think probably it was Henry Ford and some industrialists and went together somewhere around the turn of the previous century, trying to find a way to educate the workplace for the assembly line. And to me, the schools were designed on the assembly line model. And unfortunately, even though General Motors and the UAW did come to an agreement this morning, those types of jobs, those entry jobs into the middle class, have begun to disappear. And in spite of it maybe a good decision that they made, these two, I suspect those kinds of jobs are continuing to go south or to Asia or somewhere. And so that means that our workforce now needs to be prepared for a lot of change, a lot of different kinds of jobs. And I don't think the present system is meeting the challenge sufficiently. And that's what makes the change this morning.
I guess I would go along the same lines, but I would say kind of like the economy or the world of work would be considered the cheese. And when we talk about the hem and haw sitting outside of that station C, and they got comfortable, they liked it, and they didn't even know where the cheese came from, but it was there for them, and they enjoyed it. But once they got moved, that's when problems came, and they just stayed there and stayed, and then it just stuck and stuck until they couldn't, they had to do something. And I think we find ourselves in that same situation where, we've got jobs that are coming up that we don't even know about. They haven't even been invented yet. So then we already know that the cheese is moving all over the place. So how do we prepare for that? And how do we send our kids out to prepare that, career changes are going to be 5 to 7 times on the average. So how do we allow them to look into that? How does our system hang in there and keep continuing with all the changes?
And I think if we tend to agree that the cheese that has moved is actually what we need as an end product after our students have gone through their education, I think that now it's time to talk about how we're going to get them there. And the three things that I wrote down that really seriously have to be looked at and change would be the curriculum itself, not just adding on more curriculum, but being brave and cutting back that curriculum that is no longer relevant. Also, the school year in general, we have to start talking about a school year that I'm going to say year-long, and that doesn't, to me, it doesn't, it could be on for 3 months and off for the 15 days, like some schools have tried already, or some form of that. It doesn't necessarily have to add to the days that the students attend, although I would like to see that happen. I have to stress that. There's a transitional period where we get everybody used to this new idea. But changing the school year would do what we've talked about before, which is help students retain that information that they lose over the summer. So the school year is one thing I'd like to look at. The other thing that would need to be looked at is testing. There are countries that test so much better than we did. I have a principal in my district that just got back from Finland, and she talked and talked about their system there. And she said the thing about Finland is their testing is so very relevant. And we want to test because we want to hold each other accountable, but we also have to make sure that it's relevant to the students. And the tests that we give really have our high stakes to the students. That would give the test, I think, more value. So the three things I would like to see change as we are trying to find our new cheese would be the curriculum, the school year, and the testing that we're doing now.
Excellent. Thank you very much. As I read the book, I was
It was quite some time ago, so I was very new to the thought process of high school redesign. And I immediately went to the thought of the cheese that has been moved is the high school diploma. There used to be, the high school diploma used to buy you a lot. And now the high school diploma basically it's just not adequate. Now we need to be preparing all children for some sort of post-secondary experience, whether it be a two-year technical college, a two-year associate's arts degree, or a four-year college, or whatever the case may be. But for students now, the culture has changed. We have moved, the cheese has moved. And so we need to bring students along with us, and we need to change our mindset also. But thank you very much, Numbers, for that, for your reflections on that. And as we move into the beginning of the night, I just want to recap a couple of things from the last meeting. The members and myself have talked a couple of times about how interesting the last meeting was. And I think one of the most profound statements was after our meeting was that everybody should have this information that we had last Wednesday night. And I would agree. And so if nothing else, I just thank these members here for being here tonight to at least be here to hear the information. But I think one of the points made was by Mr. Gillespie, and he talked about the future growth in the Minnesota workforce is going to depend on productivity. He mentioned that word often, and he continually associated it, though, to education. And the way to get more productivity from our workforce is through education. The other thing that was very startling is that next year, beginning in next year, 30% more people, 30% of more of our population will have hit the age 62. You combine some of these facts along with we are facing or going to be facing a teacher shortfall. You combine some of these facts, and it's startling. It is really alarming, and I think it is incumbent upon us to start looking at some short-term solutions and some long-term solutions to this. If we really do care about the Minnesota economy and keeping Minnesota an economic strength in the world. Some of the other comments that I wanted to make, the other members have already mentioned them, so I won't repeat them. But, I think one word, though, it can describe what we talked about last week, and that was change. And so as I thought about what do we talk about next, the question kept coming back to me is, okay, we all know now that change is here. It has happened. And now how do we react as a state? And so today we are very fortunate to have Mr. Jim Benson, who is the President Emeritus for Bemidji State University. Do you all have a bio in your packet?
Yeah.
Liz, did they all get one? Okay, thank you. If you look at his biographical sketch, you will see that he is he has a wide range of experience, education in the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin. And in the interest of time, I am not going to go through that because I have just spent I've spent a little time with him on the phone, and then I spent about the last 20 minutes with him. And I'm going to coin my own introduction for him. I feel like he is the Minnesota version of Tom Friedman. He understands the future, has studied the future. He has gone in to many organizations, public, private, all over the world, and he has gained an understanding of where education needs to go in the future. And he just hasn't gained that understanding. He has some real life experience of how he can do it, and he has actually implemented it into the organizations that he has been at. So it is my understanding, Mr. Benson, that your presentation is going to cover all of those experiences, so I'm just going to go ahead and hand it over to you. And forgive me for not going through all of this.
Thank you. I always tell people, do the
Ed McMahon thing, just that here, yeah. Representative Dietrich, thank you for the invitation and the committee, and both are here. I'm very excited to be here tonight to share some ideas about tomorrow and what comes at, next week, because things are moving so fast, and I want to be able to do that. Right out of the chute, I want to just mention a little bit about Jim Benson comes with his transparencies and why doesn't he have the PowerPoint or other things with him. I had to ditch the PowerPoint almost immediately when it came out because it made me a sequential presenter, and I'm a random access presenter. I keynote at 100 conventions a year, and I've learned to read the crowd and shuffle the deck on the fly, and so this is going to be a very fast presentation. I'm not going to rely too much on the illustrations, but I'll throw some up there just to give you a feel for it, and then go from there. First off, the quote you see up there, in the past the survivor may be defined as the person strong enough to cope with hardship, but in the future the survivor may be defined as the person smart enough to adapt to change. This comes in the context of my grandfather. John and I just talked a little bit about Grandfather Benson. Grandfather Benson came to this country from Norway in the 1800s and got himself a homestead in northwestern Minnesota. And his homestead was where the pines quit and before the prairies start, there's a hardwood transition forest that wobbles down the center of the state. And he got himself 160 acres of solid white oak timber. And he had to build a cabin on there with one door, one window of certain dimensions. He had to live there 6 months a year for 5 years, and then they had what's called proof of claim. It became his. Now, how did he clear that land? It was with axe and saw and horses, maybe fire, you know, 160 acres, you know, of white oak timber, cleared that thing off. And when he was up in his 80s, I was like 5 or 6, and he'd hold me on his knee and tell me pioneer stories. And my head would literally spin. I know he embellished them a little as he talked about the wolves and the hardships, and my eyes would get about this big. But he would totally not understand the world that his grandson is living in, who he personally held on his knee, because the time of Grandfather Benson was closer related to the time of the Pharaohs, a muscle power world, than his grandson, who he held on his knee and talked to. Now, the other day I caught the 5 o'clock flight out of Bemidji, flew down here to the Twin Cities, went out to Washington, D.C., worked all day, came back on the 3 o'clocker, and I was back home again. So I had breakfast at home, dinner at home, but my work day was in Washington, D.C. What will my grandson Andy say someday? Why did my grandpa have to do that? Because there's a whole new world that's going to be 1,000 times bigger and further away from me and my grandkids than I had for my grandfather, who was tied to the time of the Pharaohs. And we're going to be talking about that and how do we handle those kinds of things in that kind of a setting. First off, I need to just give you a little bit of a snapshot of where I come from. I spent most of my career at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. And I was the dean of the College of Technology there, which was a huge college. It was bigger than Bemidji State. It had 4,000 undergrads in it, all the grad programs. We had established 7 self-sustaining research and development centers, some of them with multi-million dollar projects in them, and we ran them all over the world. And so it was a really dynamic kind of environment. We were doing things that nobody else had ever done before. You know, we had the first baccalaureate in quality 40 years ago. We had the first on-campus incubator to start up companies 40 years ago. We had the first 15-credit sequence in future studies that any major could take, whether you were in, you know, in the liberal arts or in engineering or whatever. You could take that 15-credit in futures to attach to your degree, and we had that 40 years ago. I was at a World Future Conference a couple of years ago, and one of the Ivy League schools said, we just added our second course in futures, and we got a lot of applause for that, and I thought, well, 40 years ago, we had a 15-credit sequence in that, and so I've been involved and a member of the World Future Society for close to 40 years in these kinds of settings. So my last project at Stout was to build the research park for the university. So we built a 114 acres called the South Technology Park. With all the curb, gutter, sewer, water, optics, gas, lighting, landscaping, everything in place, and we didn't spend one state or federal dollar to do it. You say, well, how did you do it then? Well, you went to who is going to benefit. Again, looking at change and the kind of things, if you depend on other people solving your problems, you're not going to get them done. So you look at the ways that you can get this done. The first thing we did is we went to the university and said, look, we're going to create really an exciting environment here for students and faculty to be interacting with these advanced research-type companies. So the university's foundation put in $500,000. Then we went to the city of Menominee, which is not a very big community, 14,000 people, and said, we're going to create high-technology, whistle-clean, good-paying jobs. So they put in $500,000 on this thing. Then we went, at that time, with NSP, Wisconsin's Excel now, and said, look, you can't take your power poles and high lines and go south. You've got to stay here and help build the economy. So they put in $500,000, and then we built a very conservative business plan that if we sold 1.5 lots a year for over 17 years, all three parties got all their money back, plus the carrying charge on their money. In 1994, when I went up to Bemidji, I chaired that park board, even though at that time I was president of Dunwoody College of Technology now, and I was commuting in and out because my wife was working for a technical college out there, but I still chaired Stout's Technology Park Board. In 1994, Menominee, Wisconsin, which is half the size of Bemidji, in 1 year, created 2,225 high-tech jobs that year. They have since doubled the research park, added another 105 acres to it, and have now taken out an option on another farm, and it's a 304-acre research park tied to the university, and it is an economic engine that won't quit. And so if I give you that kind of a setting, every time we are in any organization, the first thing you got to start looking at is how do we get this thing out in front? I looked at the agenda title that you have here, Minnesota's Changing Demographics and Workforce Needs, how do we react? I reacted to that title as inappropriate. We should not react. We should create. We should be out in front and doing those kinds of things, because if we're reacting, it's too late. And so we got to be reading the future and defining from the future. We choose our future ahead of time and go from that aspect. I ended up spending the last 7 years of my career at Bemidji State University, and we completely reinvented the university to a very, very creative place, and it was an exciting kind of venture. I don't have time to spend on that, but just the kinds of things that are going on. We're in 22 different countries with all kinds of activities that are going on. Students from close to 40 countries going to the university. We led and are leading in distance learning. 14% of all the students who graduate from Bemidji State will never step a foot on the campus. It's so big in Toronto, Canada, we have to go hold commencement in Toronto a whole day in the spring. We have just opened up the Central Asian Institute in Ankara, Turkey, and that's going to be moving across Central Asia and all, you know, in those kinds of developments. So as we are starting to see the kind of things that are going on, one of the things we did was we built a Center for Research and Innovation, which was a front porch for business and industry at the university up there. And that thing, that's over $1 million worth of work. It's got 40 to 50 projects all over the world, and our students and faculty are interacting with the public and designing the new future. One of the projects we did out of there was a World Bank project out of South Korea. 84 universities bid on that project, and we got on the final short list, the final three: University of Southern California, Columbia University, and Bemidji State. We got the project, and 24 PhD electrical engineers from 17 universities came to the university and for 6 weeks got the latest applications of the digital revolution as they applied to telecommunications, robotics, automation, and those whole fields. And as a result of that, we have 17 sister institutions in South Korea. And that's going on in country after country after country as we're doing these sort of things. One of the other things we invented, the Northern Tier High Technology Corridor. It operates out of that Center for Research and Innovation. The Northern Tier High Technology Corridor was the very first knowledge management portal in the world, and it was running out of that center. It was the first release by Oracle and IBM, and as a result of that, we have many, you know, communities and clusters working in the web world there off of that, and this little center is getting 1.5 million visits a month. And so you can kind of see, you know, you can be up in the North Woods, we call it the Great Knowledge Resource of the North, but that doesn't mean you can't be doing things that are very creative and stepping out in front of things. Another thing I want to talk to you about is a very interesting program that we call the Societal Changes and the Local Community and Global Community Scale, the Reinventing of Community. We are right in the middle of reinventing Bemidji. When I retired, as a result of having too much time on my hands, I guess, I decided one of the things we needed to do was to reinvent our community. Because I started to look around, and the first thing I saw was the community is really growing way too fast. And the first thing that was happening was the bulldozer would come out and bulldoze down the woods, and up would go a strip mall. They'd bulldoze down another woods, and up would go a big box. And I went to the city council and said, hold it, we've got to reforest the city. And he said, well, who's got more trees than Bemidji? And I said, no, we've got to plant 10,000 trees a year for the next 10 years to overcome the damage that has happened up to this point. And they said, well, really? I said, yeah. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, tell me the kind of feeling you get when you drive through Brainerd and Baxter today. It's 10 miles of concrete and lights, and it isn't until you get up to Nisswa it starts being up north again. What kind of a feeling do you get when you go to Itasca State Park? Oh, that's so beautiful. I said, okay, we got to plant 10,000 trees a year. If we would, 40 years from now, want the Bemidji to look like that. But it was far bigger. And so we called a meeting in the community, and we asked anybody who has an interest in our community of what it would look like, the optimum Bemidji, 15 years from now, show up at this meeting. And we had this meeting in our New American Indian Resource Center, and it was a packed house. It was absolutely packed. People from all stratas of our community came out. We brought in Mary Jo Waits and the Morrison Institute out of Phoenix to talk about some what-ifs and what-could-be's. I gave them a little stemwinder speech and asked anybody who would step forward as steward of place to do so, to take the lead and make this thing happen. 25 leaders in the community stepped up. We've been meeting for 3.5 years, twice a month at 7 in the morning, charting this course. The first thing we did is we went out and listened to the community. And over the first 8 months, we held 140 listening sessions using Collins' Good to Great model. And we listened through those three lenses of what can we be best at, which turned out to be our community assets. What are we really passionate about, which turns out to be your community values, and what will bring us prosperity, which is your economic engine. And after 8 months and 140 meetings and data that wouldn't quit, we dumped our stewards into a two-day strategic planning session and came out of that with our brand new destiny for Bemidji. And that new destiny is one that came from the people. And 2 years ago, on the 4th of July, we held a Declaration of Interdependence Day and asked the community to come in and sign off on it. And we did it on the courthouse lawn with bands and balloons and this great big sign-off that this is the new Bemidji. Now, you all know that that Collins has something called Big Hairy Audacious Goals, BHAGs. But we didn't think we could call them that. So we call them our destiny drivers. And to keep the mystique up and the energy in the community, we rolled out a destiny driver every Sunday on the front page of the Bemidji Pioneer for 17 consecutive Sundays. And these are truly big, hairy, audacious goals. One of them is to plant 10,000 trees a year for 10 years, and we planted 30,000 already. Another one is to take our school system and put it in the top 5 in the state. Another one is to take our incidence of alcohol and drug abuse to the lowest percentage in the state. Another one is to take our hospital and put it in the top 100 in the nation out of 3,000-some hospitals that fall in our category. Another one is to find and develop 5 new knowledge economies that will drive our economy in Bemidji. We got 2 of them off and running already, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But, you know, you kind of see, you can be in command and not be reacting, because if we were being reacting, we'd have been, you know, calling all kinds of meetings and, you know, this isn't good and that's good. Instead, they've got the whole community energized, looking to the future and doing those kinds of things. So as we look at that, and one of the things I want to talk with you about tonight is how fast the world is changing and its needs for, you know, the economic sector. And if we took a look at society's development, we were at one time a hunting and gathering era, on up to an agrarian age, the age of exploration, trade and commerce, the industrial age, the space and information age. And where we are today is something I just coined it the age of light. Some have called it the age of knowledge. But this particular, you know, it's a different rules apply for a society that's reached this point. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. The evolving U.S. economy. The first 100 years of our country's history was about who could build the biggest and most efficient farm. The second, that was my grandfather Benson. The second 100 years was the race for to build the most efficient factory. The third 100 years is about ideas. Ideas, ideas, ideas. And let me give you an example of what I mean by that. If you pull up a Business Week magazine, you'll see ads from companies that help other companies with ideas. Accenture Corporation has one of those, and this is one of the ads from Accenture Corporation. It says, I am your idea. One day you look for me and I'll be gone. In other words, Alfred North Whitehead, the philosopher, said it a little differently. He says, ideas don't cheat. Something has to be done about them. But what they're talking about here is that if you don't grab these ideas, the surf is going to come up and wash it away. Another Accenture ad went this way. I am your idea. Competitors may be closer than they appear. You know, and you start to see these kinds of things happening. John, you mentioned the Henry Ford and the production line. Henry Ford shattered all the ideas of how we did work at one time, because his first handmade car cost $9,000 to build. Soon he made Model T's for $800. He eventually got the price down to $284, built nearly 15 million. I mean, he changed America forever. He changed where we lived, how we lived. He changed the economy. It was just a whole brand new world, the industrialized world. But why we weren't looking, that has shifted into another whole era. It's the knowledge world. And what we're talking about here now is computer power is now 8,000 times less expensive than it was 30 years ago. And if we'd made similar progress in the automotive business today, you could buy a Lexus for $2. It would travel 600 miles on a thimble of gas. That's the kind of thing that's happening as a result of that. And on Valentine's Day, I gave my wife one of these Valentine cards with a computer chip in it, and it pinged out this romantic song. You know, she liked it, at least for a little while. But that computing card, that computer chip and that greeting card, there was more computing capacity in that card than there was in the world in 1950. And so if we're moving in this kind of era and looking at the kind of things going on, it is calling for a different kind of sector. Last week, I spent the day at the 3M Innovation Center. They're one of my favorite idea companies for a big corporation. Lots of little corporations got lots of ideas, but for a big corporation, they've been able to sustain their ideas. This may not come through, I'm not sure. It's blacked out. But basically, what it's saying is that they have enough ideas coming out every year that it'll replace one-fifth of the ideas they need in the company. So in 5 years, they'll have a brand new company. Well, they really don't, because some of the old stuff still makes money. But, you know, here's a company with 60,000 plus products, 400 a year, new ones. And their best guess is it takes, you know, 500 ideas for one to come off the top. And they even make money on their mistakes. If the glue won't stick, sell it as post-it notes. And it goes on and on and on about the creativity in that. And if you ever have a chance to go through the Innovation Center, which is a fairly new thing there that they use for their customers, they have all of their technology platforms laid out and what that means for the company. They cut across the divisions. And just take one platform, for instance, is the orienting of light-emitting film. And, you know, in your computer, in order to make your batteries last twice as long, they had to get more light from what it was producing to go through the screen rather than to be dissipated inside and get the screen all hot in the back. So by putting this film on, it orients the light rather than going all over like this to all shoot up through that screen, and it doubled the life of the battery. Well, that little thin film that orients light is on every laptop built in the world. It's on every cell phone. It's on every iPod. It's going to be on every flat screen. That one technology is worth $2 billion in trade every year for 3M. One idea is a $2 billion idea. And so we need to be looking at those kind of things. Harry Quadrasi, one of my favorite CEOs, he passed away now, but he had a very big corporation in Wisconsin, and his motto was, change is our bread and butter, we see it as our job security. Change is our bread and butter, we see it as our job security. Most people think, well, I hope we don't change so much, then I'll feel secure. If you're not changing, you ought to be feeling very insecure, but somebody is changing. You mentioned productivity if you kick the things off. Gary Hedstromer heads up our electronics plant for Nortec in Bemidji. Spoke at Rotary one day and he said, we have to bid our work at a rate 15% lower than we did last year in order to sell our product. And if we can't do that, the customer will go elsewhere. And so he says, we've had to bid it 15% lower, then we have to show a profit. Where does that come from? It's a little magic word called productivity. And it's going on year after year after year, and you say, boy, Nortec hurting today? No, they're a far better company today because they were able to do it. I have walked through a company a week for 40 years. One day I'm down here on 494, it's walking through the Seagate plant. They make the recording head that goes in the hard disk on your computer. There's over 3,000 people working in that facility. It's a very, very high-tech facility. And Pat Bonney, who runs that place, you know, he made this comment that they had to pull out on all the strings to be able to stay alive in that industry. And he says, we have reduced our cost in recording head operations 1% a week for 15 years. Can you imagine reducing your cost 1% a week for 1 year? There's 52 weeks in that year, and you've done that for over 15 years. You say, how in the world are you still in business? That's the reason they are, and lots of other people aren't. And that's the work world that our people are needing to go into those kinds of fields, because in that facility, it's either 32 or 34% of every person in that facility, their full-time job is research in process engineering, material science, etc., because they're going to have to squeeze more and more and more capability and reduce and reduce and reduce their costs if they're doing those sort of things. Last week I hosted the Blandin Foundation. I'm on their board of trustees at Bemidji, and our theme was for the three-day retreat, building for the knowledge-based economy. So I took them through a whole bunch of exciting things that are going on. One of them that I brought them through was Wells Technology. Andy Wells is one of my former faculty members, took a leave of absence, and then when he ran out of time on that, he resigned and kept going with this company. 8 years after starting that company, he had 40 employees, 10,000 products, and sold them in 29 different countries. And he has now started the Wells Academy, a side operation, a 501c3 nonprofit for educating Native Americans, because Andy himself is a Red Lake enrollee. And it is absolutely a spectacular success as you see these things happening. Andy is designing on the fly. He never makes the same thing twice. He's into defense. He's into space ages. He's into the latest and toughest high-tech, you know, ventures that you can imagine, and just flying. And as a result of that, what Andy is doing is selling knowledge. 3 weeks ago, I had a person come to the campus to see our new Center for Advanced and Emerging Technology, a guy named Bob Cervanka, who started a company called Phillips Plastics in Phillips, Wisconsin. Now, Phillips Plastics is sort of, Phillips is sort of like Ely in Minnesota. It's way out there in the woods. And Bob had a secondhand injection molding machine in a rented cheese factory, and he molded toys. He made Batman and Robin. And so he came to us down at Stealth when I was there, and he says, hey, if I stay in the high-volume, low-margin business of labor-based work, pouring resin in this mold, the Orient will get me in 6 months. They'll make Batman and Robin cheaper than I can. So I need to, you know, work with you to go into value-added engineering, so I'm selling the knowledge in my product rather than the physical amount that's in the product or how much physical work I handled that product with, the labor part. And so today, if you go into Phillips, Wisconsin, you'll see two beautiful facilities there, plus world headquarters. But over these 31 years, there's been 31 companies developed in Milwaukee, Beaverton, Fredonia, Medford, Tune, Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls, Prescott, Hudson, New Richmond, Four and White Bear Lake, Carmel, California, Boise, Idaho, North Carolina Research Triangle, four brand new facilities in South Research Park, and a multi-million dollar facility hanging on the Mississippi River Bluff across from Hastings. And he is, in my opinion, today one of the top five polymer companies in the world. I mean, selling vein extensions, medical instruments, perfect spheres for back fusions, lattice work to grow stem cells on. I mean, you know, instead of, you know, making Batman and Robin, he's selling products for $1,000 or $10,000 a piece, and it's all knowledge is the result of that. And a huge proportion of his product is being shipped right into the Orient, because he's out on the front end and dealing with the latest knowledge and being able to do that. And with all these facilities, he needs different kind of people. He needs creative people. He needs people that are willing and ready to change, because he will get a company up and going and he'll sell it to get some more money to start a higher tech one, a more advanced one, a more knowledgeable one, as we're moving through those sort of things. So we see that sort of happening. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a phone call from the CEO of a very large Fortune 500 company. It's this huge corporation with plants in 15 states. And he said, I would like to have you come to Scottsdale for 2 days and take us through a two-day strategic planning session. I said, well, I don't know if I got the time. Well, we finally found the time and decided to do it. But just as we were hanging up the last time before we were going out, they said, Jim, do one thing for us when you come out there. And I said, what's that? Hit us in the head with a 2x4 to get our attention. Because he says, frankly, we're getting our lunch eaten. And he was wise enough to see that. Because what most people don't see in the corporate world, we lost one half the Fortune 500 companies during the decade of the 80s. Half of them. Why? Because they had no vision, they couldn't move quickly enough, and so they got bought out, spun off. You know, it's just a mess. It's, and big disasters going on, and we needed to do things differently. So as I walked into that session, I started out with this. This is the 2x4 in the head. You know, big needs and shrinking accommodations. The opening statement for that session. Now, there are 29, the CEO and 29 executives sitting in a horseshoe kind of like this. And each of the 15 plant general managers were there, and then the executive suite. And so the opening statement went this way. Everybody in this room only knows 30% of what you're going to need to know to run this operation 5 years from now. If you could have read the body language, I mean, they were stiff as a rod, their faces were tight, and I could just read their minds. Now, who in the world is this person, not even from our sector, telling us we only know 30% of what we need to know? Well, of course that's what they know, because what are the answers to the questions that haven't even been asked yet? Because what they have done to the point, they've milked all the productivity and efficiencies out of the 30% that they know, and the answers are in the other 70% that they don't know. And what are those answers and where are they? Every minute, there are 25 new breakthroughs somewhere in this world. That's 25,000 brand new things today we didn't have yesterday. There'll be 25,000 tomorrow. That's millions of new major breakthroughs happening in every year as we're moving along in that facet. And so if we start to see that and say, how do we know that? Two professors in California aggregated all the knowledge that we developed in the year 2002. And as they did that, you know, they found out that we developed enough knowledge in the year 2002 to fill 500,000 libraries of Congress in 1 year. If every person on the face of this earth would have been assigned to do their share, so I did my share and you did your share, you know, every one of us, 6.3 or 4 billion of us, would have had to generate a bookshelf 30 feet long for 1 year's worth of knowledge. That's the world that we're educating for. That's why we need to redesign the school system. That's why we need creativity. We need, you know, to be teaching on the fly, creating brand new things, doing things in different kinds of ways, and, you know, causing those kind of things to happen in a whole different kind of way as we look to the future. Now, I get so excited here that I'm going to have to show you a few things. This is really a Reader's Digest version. I hope you appreciate that. If you ask me about the refocus for the, you know, for the workforce and what we need for society, so I'm going to structure it to hit that slant. And it's not that I don't value the arts and the theater and all that, because I do. My wife and I love theater and arts and music and this sort of thing. But this is going to be on the engine that's going to run the future of this state and this country and this world as we take a look at it. I spent a lot of time on this. You know, decades and decades. I've been on national and international policy boards and designing curriculum. Right now, we've got semi-loads of curriculum to support this. We have, you know, national standards of technologies that are already built and validated on the international level. And it's everything that a preschooler or, you know, up to third grader would need to know to be technologically literate. It's everything for a third grader up to a fifth grader, what they should know to be technologically literate. It's every middle school child, what they need to know to be technologically literate in this kind of world, built on these kind of things that we're just talking about, and the high school level. To give you a little feel for that, yesterday I was in Brilliant, Wisconsin, and they're the home of Aaron's Manufacturing, which makes snowblowers and lawnmowers. Aaron's very big corporation, a big solid citizen in the community. Brilliant, Wisconsin, in their high school, just put in a brand new engineering lab. Totally funded, $1.5 million. Aaron's built it for them. Other corporations are supplying the equipment for this sort of thing. And this facility is built for the future, because I'll explain that a little. I was asked to go over and do the keynote for the big dedication, and it was a statewide event. They had people from all over the state in there to celebrate this new idea of this school. Now, as we take a look at that, how are we going to be doing these sort of things? We have to look at the world differently. We have in Bemidji, as I was mentioning, these Bemidji leads we're building 5 new knowledge economies. One of them is called the Ingenuity Frontier. The Ingenuity Frontier is for the total northwestern Minnesota. It involves Marvin Windows and Doors, Polaris, Articat, Digi-Key, Team Industries, D Corporation, all of the corporations in northwestern Minnesota, to help them stay on the front end of the design needs and to design on the fly and get the product out the door before the competition catches on what's going on. That means we have to have a different kind of person involved in that kind of work. So we got, I think it's a dozen high schools that are doing Project Lead the Way, TIDE, and all these engineering and technology programs up there. And then we have 2 technical colleges, a community college, 3 foundations, and 2 brand new engineering degrees, and the university, and a brand new building. On the Bemidji State campus, there's a brand new building called the Center for Advanced and Emerging Technology, and it's designed as a building the way you design new solutions. So the top floor is imagination and ideation. You dream these things up. The second floor is innovation and invention. You build the 3D ideas and design them, rapid prototyping and prototype engineering and all that sort of thing. And the bottom floor is implementation. Get it out the door. And as a result of that, we cannot produce enough of the students coming through that particular program. I mean, we've got one program, it's the art-based program and technology and engineering-based. So as the students come into the program, they're in the art studio. So it's rooted in art, design, and aesthetics, math, science, engineering, and technology, and we turn out Imagineers. And it is so exciting to see the creative work and the design work, and they are just being able to design these things on the fly. Now, if we looked at... how much time have I got here? Another 10 minutes?
Yes.
Okay.
15 minutes, yeah.
I'll squeeze it here. So. Okay. If we looked at all knowledge that we have in society, and this is, if we went up 30,000 feet and looked down at the whole field of knowledge, and this comes from the philosophers, Alfred North Whitehead and people like that, who kind of categorize knowledge in logic, and that's where they look at, they would say that all knowledge falls into 3 big balls plus a field. And the big balls are the humanities, the sciences, and the technologies. And around it is something called formal knowledge, which is how we handle and manipulate knowledge. It's mathematics and logic and all that. It's the tool for that. Now, if you look in your folder, there's two little colored balls. Those illustrations are there. That is all knowledge, and it's sitting in, you know, as a knowledge base. Now, knowledge is one thing, but how do we adapt as a society? We adapt systematically. And if you go to the sociology literature and look at that at 30,000 feet, they basically say you adapt in only three ways. You adapt ideologically, sociologically, and technologically, and you do that in both the natural and the built environment. Now, that's how we adapt, and we don't adapt randomly. We adapt systematically. And as a result of that, you get the two balls interacting back and forth together. As you know more, you adapt better. As you adapt more, you learn more to put in the knowledge base. So, you know, one is the static thing, one is adaptive thing. If you look at that little ball, you'll notice that if you look at the knowledge that's housed in the left ball there, is discipline-oriented. So the science, if you break out science, what do you break it out into? The disciplines of physics, chemistry, biology, you know, etc. If you look at technology and you broke them out as a discipline, there is a noun, it becomes mechanical, electrical, civil, etc. That's you see that in universities and so forth. But over on the right side, when you get the systems, they cut across the disciplines. As you learn to adapt, you cut across the disciplines. So, if you look at those systems, you have manufacturing systems. You have communication systems. That's what people do. So to develop a system-based curriculum, you don't study the discipline, you study what people do. And you design it around what people do. It is an extremely popular program, but it is extremely demanding because you better be right on the money, because when your graduates go out, they expect them to be able to do that. If they go out in a discipline, like a mechanical engineer, somebody from the corporation will say, it takes us 6 months, 8 months to bring them up to speed, you know, but they don't give you that path when you have a systems-oriented one. You'll find that a program based in engineering at the University of Minnesota is one around mechanical, electrical, etc. The program that you see based at South or St. Thomas is around systems. So you go to St. Thomas, you see, you know, manufacturing systems courses. And so that gives you a little insight in what's going on there. If you look at the difference between science and technology, there's a very interesting thing about the process. The process of science is the scientific method. And to do that, of course, you state the question, develop the hypothesis, conduct the experiment, you observe, gather data, draw inferences, and what comes out the other end are theories, laws, or affirmations that you replicate research. That's one way to think, the scientific method. That's way different than thinking in the technological method, the engineering method. Engineering as a verb, it's a whole different way to think. Because now you have to identify a want or a need, not a problem. I want or I need this. Then you design, develop, invent, innovate, problem solve. You work through that thing. You end up with a solution, and you can patent it or copyright it or license it or something afterward like that. So there's two completely different ways to think in science compared to technology. But usually in our school systems, we will see that we don't teach a lot of technology and a lot of technological process. We might teach computers and call it technology, but we spend 12 years teaching math, we spend 12 years teaching science, we maybe teach one semester in the middle school as a requirement to teach technology. Or we might teach them a little bit to use computers, but it's more of a use one. Now, if you took a look at this whole field of technology, you'll see there are disciplines, electrical, mechanical, civil. There are systems, you know, if you move across, and there are processes. I will share with you when I get home tomorrow the most stunning example of why we need to understand systems. Maybe some of you sat in on on Life Science Alley's winter presentation last spring, where Dr. Lee Hood came in and he made this presentation. Dr. Lee Hood is a biologist, and he was at Caltech, and he came up with some ideas that left the science and wanted to get over in the system. And the dean and the president told him, get back over in the science, you know, forget that practical kind of stuff. And he says, well, I think we got something here that even could be a company. He says, don't treat ourselves with commercial stuff. Stay away from it. So he left Caltech and he went to the University of Washington. And because the dean there said he could do both science and technology, the system. But the dean left after a year and he went right back. You know, he said, if you want tenure, you stay in the sciences. So he just walked up and left it. He went to Bill Gates and formed the Institute for Systems Biology, the technology of biology. The rest is history. He's the most proficient inventor and developer you could ever imagine. Five of the major pieces of equipment that permitted us to do the Human Genome Project, the DNA arrays, and all of these things came out of that work. He couldn't have done it in the scientific method because then you're just solving the problem. He got over into the development of creating brand new pieces of equipment. He has formed four new companies out of that, including Amgen, a $200 billion company, 600 refereed and, you know, papers for the profession, and he's going to change medicine and the whole field magnificently in the next 5 years. I will shoot that to you and you can share it among your committee. It is an astounding indictment about teaching and operating in the past when we really need to be looking to the future of what needs to be done. Well, I could go all day here, but I think I'll stop and just post some time for some questions and so forth.
That's a great idea. Questions for Mr. Benson? While you might be contemplating a question, I would like to welcome Senator Rest. I didn't recognize her again. She just looks so rested and refreshed and young. Senator Rest, would you like to join us up at the table?
Sure.
Yeah, I saw you kind of wiggling. I kind of saw you wiggling in your chair, and I thought those chairs are not good for the back. And we do a lot of sitting in this business.
I have for you, Mr. Chairman, the NIDRI Lead Destiny Driver, and you can order that too. If you go to the webpage, you'll see all of these on NIDRILead.com. And if we have just received a large financial package of $600,000 to $700,000 from a number of foundations to start walking this across the state under something called the Center for Community Stewardship. And in there's some streaming technology stuff to get a real good feel for what this is doing. It's absolutely marvelous. It's to energize the community.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Swells.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. President Benson, I'm curious about what you were telling us about the ingenuity frontier. That is such a, I don't know, just kind of a mind-expanding concept, and I can see high school students just gravitating just to the energy that is around the concept. And I was wondering if you would explain that in a little more detail.
It's so exciting. In fact, the enrollment in this Brilliant Wisconsin program tripled in 1 year when they got a chance to do engineering problems. You're all familiar with the super mileage vehicle competition where you give them this engineering problem each year and a team of students works to solve the problem, and then they're raced competitively at the Brainerd, you know, raceway every spring. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're not over 700, 800, even 1,000 miles per gallon, you're not in the contest. And so we're seeing things being, you know, designed and built like hovercraft and remote control flyby systems. And I was in a middle school in Haley, Idaho, and a guy by the name of Brad Thody, they had a science unit in their technology and engineering lab, and they had built a space station in the lab that hydraulically would dock, It had a fiber optic communication system with mission control up by the principal's office. There were three other schools in Maine, Texas, and somewhere else that they were communicating with. They went to Hewlett-Packard and got an excess robot, and they had the robot out in the lab then that they were controlling from the capsule remotely to assemble a gantry system out there. I mean, these are real problems. That's the state-of-the-art, you know, running edge. And so, by the way, Brad's wife is the elementary technology specialist. Like you have the music specialist go around, the art specialist. She does the technology stuff. And, I mean, these elementary kids are into rocketry and automation, robots. It's really exciting. And Brad says, boy, I really have to be up high because by the time they come out of fifth grade and I get them, you know, they've already had a lot of these kinds of experiences. There's no top to the human ingenuity in their mind. And too many times, I think if we teach to test and do lockstep things across our state, we're going to get people that will answer the test and not be able to create the future.
I have a follow-up to that, Madam Chair. President Benson, I guess with that very concept right there, you are such an optimistic soul, and I really appreciate that. We don't have a lot of optimism at the Capitol sometimes, so it's very nice to hear that. But if you did have an indictment of public education today or education in general, what is it that you think we are doing that is not serving our students and not serving our future well?
I think a couple things. One, we're not opening the door to let the high flyers really fly. We're educating to maybe narrow differences rather than to expand them. So I think the high flyers need to fly better. I think we can do a much better job with that difficult population that is dropping out of our schools. And when I was at Dunwoody, we started the Youth Career Awareness Program there. You probably are somewhat familiar with that. But we went into the schools of this city and identified after ninth grade people that the social worker, the counselor, the principal, and the teacher said probably won't be around next year or will certainly not make it more than another 18 months and we won't see them anymore. We took those students through a wild and woolly world all summer long. You have smoke, sparks, chips, and noise. They were excited about these sort of things and moving on through the kinds of things that could happen. And as a result of that, we had a 93% completion of high school. And 83% of those 93% went on to higher ed. And that's been so successful that they have now created their own charter school over there to try to do this with bigger numbers. So I think that population is getting, coming up a little short. It's a difficult environment, and I know I've spent a lot of time working in those environments. I've spent a lot of time working in the Native American communities, and it is not easy. But we have to get inside, you know, the thinking process of how that works and make it happen.
Representative Benson, did you have a question?
Well, I remember not too long ago being in the classroom and seeing a number of my young colleagues leave, go off to industry, go off to business for all kinds of reasons, not just the economic ones, but many times that as well. Considering the fact that our Constitution requires that we teach all children as much as possible, it means we have to have qualified teaching corps. How do we get that when we've got folks like you competing for these people?
Boy, that's really complex. It's complex at the university. To try and hire an engineer with a PhD or a technology person is impossible. So we almost have to hire masters plus and grow them ourselves, and then somebody else steals them. It is so complex. We're having students going out of Bemidji State right now for salaries higher than we're paying the professors. They are so marketable. At the energy conference last week that we had in St. Cloud, one of our professors told the story of this one student who, you know, is a young father. He's got another one on the way. He's been just struggling to make it. And he's already been hired now in December. He goes out for $81,000 right out of the chute. And everybody was after him. And there's just lots and lots of those. So the world is full of great opportunities for people who can, you know, get out on the front end and make this happen. excuse me, I think there's going to be, have to be some other kinds of ways too that we define school systems, the way we define how to get in and out. We have the second oldest student body at Bemidji State, right underneath Metro State, which is designed for the working adult, but we're next, and we're rural. And so here is urban, and you've got this one, but we have so many people that get out in the community and they're locked out of the system. They got a mortgage and a family and they can't afford to go back to school, and that's why we're taking it to them and are delivering it that way. And by the way, every program at BSU is evaluated for performance by the student, you know, as a result of it, both on and off campus. And the one that gets the highest marks of all is our Toronto program. And it's delivered almost totally in the web world out there. But because you had to design it, we're not permitted by law of the province to go up there and physically teach. So we can go in on the first weekend, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, kick it off. We can come back the last weekend and do the assessment. And so they've designed some really good experiences as a result of it. I think sometimes, you know, we need to be doing more of that. We need to design and get into things in a different kind of way. A lot of, you know, web-based learning that's going on, and, you know, K all the way up, you see this sort of thing, is too close to electronic page turning, for my feeling. We need to get to arcade-level interactivity. Really, arcade level. I was at the in Kansas City a few years back, the week after the FFA convention was founded. That's where all the Future Farmers of America from the nation come in there. And so we were being hosted to maybe bring a convention in there. So every night we were hosted by a different hotel. One night we were at the Holiday Inn, where downtown, across from the convention center, where the restaurant goes around. It's really a fancy place. And he was showing us these rooms, and he said, here's where you'd have your registration, here's where you'd have your exhibits, and here's where you'd have the ballroom, and here are the breakout rooms. And he walked into a room that wasn't much bigger than this, and he says, last week when the FFA was here, I cleaned this room out, and I went 50-50 with a local computer arcade company. We kept it open 24 hours for 8 days, and we split $30,000 in quarters. And the bingo, the light goes on in my head, and I think, why shouldn't we teach that with that kind of interactivity? So, what's causing them to stay with that machine? It's the competitiveness. It's that inner, visceral kind of thing they're getting. Well, we could teach algebra too that way. You know, it's just exciting. And so the teacher should be working in the role of a professional and doing diagnosis and, you know, prescriptions and treatment and assessment. And we could augment our learning like that. Maybe even collect tuition with quarters. I don't know, but there's a lot of ways you could look at the world of learning, because there's so much to learn. It's going to move so fast. And by the way, it'll end never. You know, we're seeing enormous calls from business, industry, foundation. It's continuous learning for everybody, forever, to stay on top of it. So finishing high school might be a starter. Finishing a technical college, an apprenticeship, a university, that might be, that's just part of the transition. And it never ends.
Mr. Benson.
I agree. I think there is a real role for technology. But still, we're going to have to find too many competent people interacting with children in some way. And I didn't hear an answer to that. Because...
How do we get people...
We're having people come in the profession leaving within 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
No profession can survive and be productive with such kind of with such a turnover.
Yep.
And I've heard nothing from either the Minnesota State Department of Education, or any of the universities, nor yourself, or any of my colleagues, coming up with a practical answer to that problem.
Well,
because the dollars aren't there. I don't think they'll ever be competitive with the private sector. Maybe shouldn't be. And even the monasteries are emptying out. You know, there aren't those kinds of people in sufficient numbers, I don't believe.
Yeah.
And this is a real practical problem. I agree with everything you said, but on the ground, in the classroom, how do we get these people?
I think number one, we've got to be excited in our schools so that we're spotting potential people that could be teachers. When I was at South, one of the supervisors in the Milwaukee school system, and Milwaukee is 100,000 students in the system, they would go around and pick out students that they would send to South. And Wally Cave would come up 3 times a year and have lunch with his students, because he was getting them ready, because he wanted them back in the Milwaukee system. And so he put that special effort on doing that. We see, I think we're going to have to do a lot more helping out with scholarships, maybe even paid tuitions, and they work it off over a 5-year period or something like that. We're doing that in the medical profession right now. I'm on the hospital board, and you wouldn't believe the bonuses and what we're paying to attract medical doctors to our community. And I mean, we've got 80, 90 docs in town, but we could double the number with the amount of work going on. And it's, you know, we're meeting the financial need to try and do that. I think we got to do that in education as well. And lastly, with that, it needs to be returned to the status of the profession that it is.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably all read the Lee Iacocca statement about, in any rational society, the top position in society ought to be a teacher. Because what other person in society has a chance to prepare the next generation of our society? I don't think we're really a rational society, so we're not doing that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Benson. In the interest of time, I think we had better move on. One thing for sure, in all the change that we have talked about, that one thing that we do know is that the business community, our local communities, the state, business, all needs to come together and find a shared vision for the future. And so we did not want to go on in this discussion until we had heard from our business community. So we are so fortunate tonight to have two people from the Minnesota business community here to share their perspective on what are the skills and knowledge that students, high school students, 2-year graduate students, 4-year graduate students are going to need in the future. So first I would like to introduce Bev Lowes, Vice President of Human Resources for Instant Web Companies. Welcome to the committee, Bev.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. It's excellent, and I think it bridges nicely into his expertise in talking about the passion and, you know, to what we anticipate will be the mission. And I certainly agree with the Madam Chairperson that with regard to bridging this all together with education, all the businesses that we can, all the resources that we can, is going to be fundamental to the success. I don't think anything I can say this evening with regard to what we think students will need to get into business is going to be anything new that you haven't heard. But I think the element of technology is key, because within our organization, which very much parallels with some of the experience, we're from a printing organization, and the synergy that we've had with Scout, Mr. Quadrucci, who, you know, Mr. Benson passed away, has been mentors with our organization as well, and that wasn't as planned. But the passion there to get people introduced to technology actually covers a lot what is in the STEM conference currently with the science, tech, education, and math. And a lot of the hands-on application and a lot of the learning is how do we bridge everything that's in those students that you have and make them available and ready for the workforce. I can't sit here and think we distinctively have a lot of competencies that are different in the 2-year degree than the 4-year degree. It's very, very similar, but it's probably a little bit more of the sciences that go into the 4-year degree when looking at the competencies of what we have we don't have a boilerplate template that will say this job requires all of these skill sets. We'll have the basic minimum requirements, but we're finding this ourselves needing to look more so at the potential and the capabilities of the individual. And we will look for a balanced skill set that is needed to preliminarily get into the organization, but we're finding ourselves needing to take this group of people and to what President Benson said is building our own. And we will then educate the individual with what is needed within our organization to hopefully make them successful. And it's a matter of embracing those individuals in that concept, hopefully communicating very effectively with them. We do now what is a quarterly performance review with all of our employees so that we're continually having conversation with regard to acknowledging how well they're doing within the organization and or giving them that development guidance that is needed versus telling them in November what they could have done better in the early part of February. So our ongoing education internally is always giving performance feedback, communicating on how well and recognizing those individuals within the organization, and hopefully creating a succession plan within the business. To create that linkage, however, between the school is we're trying very diligently now to get mentors within our organization. And we are actually having a meeting tomorrow with 70 employees that have volunteered to want to work with us in various districts. And we're looking at the concept of either having it be education, community, or faith-based interest with regard to how we can reach out to students and hopefully inspire and identify those great talents within those students. And whether those students are interested in our company or not, we're trying to establish that talent in the state of Minnesota to hopefully get people to accept jobs in the state as well. I think we have a job as a state to hopefully attract students to stay and want to stay in Minnesota. I think it's very interesting to see how many we populate out of the state of Minnesota into other states, other countries. But we're truly trying to bridge that with the schools. We would love to partner with schools to work with you with regard to if it's a pay for performance process in your need. And I don't know what it is, but I've heard dialogue on either end of that. And if there are things that the school systems need from the business, how can we partner with you to meet some of those, you know, systemic challenges that you have? So in turn, we can work with you as business partners with establishing those students. So it's a myriad of situations. I can sit here and say, yes, we need math, we need communications, we need, you know, more customer skills, we need the behavioral components. But we look at the well-rounded individuals having the, you know, the technology, the science, the math, as well as the behavioral issues, and putting those components together.
Any questions?
Well, there are three groups. The most important is the student, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I would say the parents. And third, those of us who partner with parents and the children for the educational process. Does your organization do anything with the larger community, particularly family? They are the ones that are really the motivators for the children.
Sure. And
we're with the students for a number of hours each day, and you know, but the parents, the family, the culture that we have here in the country is a critical one. Is there any way to get to that component?
No, I appreciate that's a very good question, and part of this, at least for our business community, is us not knowing what we don't know about the educational needs. So what we did is we went to several districts, and currently we're partnering, and not that it's any more in need or different, but the one that's willing to invest time with us, which is District 112 right now. And we thought they were going to come to us and talk about a read-to-me program or, you know, tutoring. What we found out is that they needed need for parenting. And I'll use the Asian population, for example. They informed us that the Asian parents often don't feel it's appropriate in their culture to sit with the child at home to do homework, that it's an insult to the parent who assume the role of the teacher in that culture. And so we have employees that speak that language in our organization, that we're working with the teacher and the parent to educate the parent on the importance that it's the right thing to do in this culture to sit with your student at home. We've learned that there is a need to have the teachers become better, more systems proficient. So our CIO and his team, information technology professionals, will go and work with the students, with the teachers at the time it's convenient for the teacher, to make sure that they're feeling system savvy enough, because the students often are one step ahead in some cases on the technology. So we want to help the teachers become better informed as well. And then we're also learning about what the need is for the particular child, which may be the reasoning program or computer training or math or what have you. So we've learned a lot that it's three opportunities within that school system. We also have individuals that speak, we call them language coaches in our organization, and we'll utilize those individuals and permit them paid time away to assist with any communication or language barriers within the school system. But we never would have known that had the system not told us what that need is. Mm-hmm. We thought it was purely focused on the child.
I don't think you ever commented about the size of your company. Could you do that a little bit?
The size of the company, we have 600 people in Chanhassen. We have 500 people in Little Falls, Minnesota. And we do have...
Excuse me, how many in Little Falls?
600 in Little Falls.
Really?
Yeah. So we're growing in that organization, and then we have a location in New York, North Carolina, and then we'll soon be going westward. We're a manufacturing organization. We're direct mail, which is basically a lot of that, I called junk mail when I started, but it's opportunity business mail. And it's quite the science and the art, and we have partnered a lot with the Dunwoody Institution of Technology, but we're looking for more opportunities to do some partnerships and sponsorships as well. So we're learning as we're asking those questions, and we're trying to be creative, and we have a very, very supportive president in the community, Jim Anderson, that is also on the Minnesota Business Partnership, and he's done a phenomenal job reaching out to other business leaders in the organization, and we're trying to put that connection. One thing that, I don't know if this is creating interference, what I'm learning on this, there's a lot of people having the right passion, wanting to help, and it's almost as though I wish we could bring everybody in the room to talk about the goal and then build the pattern and make the resolution to get there, because I think there's a lot of passionate people. We just probably have not taken the time to share the experiences, talk about the opportunity, and talking about those partnerships which we can create. And I'm starting to see more inroads into that. I think we're starting to connect more of the right people together. And again, I'm not here speaking just for our business, but it's very similar patterns that I'm hearing from other business councils. We're trying to team up with other companies within our local area, within perhaps a 5-mile radius within our company, to say maybe we all can't do this, but can we look at how we can subsidize a bus if it means taking a group of students somewhere to learn something, to observe something, to attach something. I used to work with GE. I partner with them still a lot right now from the technology standpoint. They were great advocates with regard to investing in the future leaders of the organization. Plus, they're very interested in institutionalizing the change, and they're very willing to give leaders to talk to groups about how to create change. They have an organization called CAP, which stands for Change Acceleration Process. Change is evolutionary. Change is sometimes fearful to people, and it tells you how to get to that next level by levels of engagement and adapting ideas, and you know, maybe putting things away that no longer are successful but that were at one point very foundationally solid for the organization, and bridging from that. But what can we do differently? What can we apply differently? And I think there's a lot of companies out there, not only with dollars or in kind, but I think there's a lot of passionate people out there. Talking with 3M, the IBM, the scientists, the technology, the engineers, You know, is there a way that they can coach and mentor in your school system? Now, again, you know this better than I, but it's my understanding that to have someone come in and perhaps mentor or teach, they need to go through certification of some sort. Is there a way that we can bridge that so you can get some of that talent and expertise to help you train those students? And we hear that there's background checks. Well, you know, can the business who has already done that for the employee, is there a way to mitigate not having to repeat some of those foundational background checks and stuff so that if there is a valid person that meets the credentials and the requirements, how can we, you know, build that inroads to have that expertise come into your classroom to give you the assistance? I hear a lot with regards to how the teachers are being pulled with regards to the various things with the students. You know, how can we partner if you have a challenge or an opportunity of sometimes, you know, how difficult or how hard is it for you to go through the steps? Again, I don't know, but if there's a language challenge that you have, do you fundamentally, can you call a business and say, we need someone to help with the interpretation for a particular student, a particular parent? I think it's out there. We're just looking at ways how we can make those mechanics happen with the businesses or with the schools.
Any further questions? I just have one other. Can you tell me a little bit about the demographics of your workforce?
Very diverse. We have a large Somalian population. We have a large Asian population that consists in and of itself 7 different dialects of Asian-speaking languages. We have an Asian Hispanic population. And a Russian and Bosnian group, which is pretty similar in the language differences. And we have, for the most part, encouraged the English language speaking skills, but our largest population is Hispanic, and it was very rewarding to hear managers and supervisors said, hey, maybe we need to take the class to understand some of the, you know, communications and some of the languages just to converse with regard to the business needs.
And what would be the education requirements for different levels of positions?
We have a competency model for various levels within the organization. So fundamentally, again, there's a finance or math expectation, there's a communication expectation, what we would call interpersonal skills, customer service type of adaptation. If it's a technical position, it would have an element of engineering, possibly certification if it was electrical in a manufacturing arena. So it varies on each job. And again, we try to make the best match with the potential, not necessarily the full set skill requirements, but we'll look for the minimum qualifications so that the person at least can start successfully in the job, and then they go through a 90-day training period. And we do our very, very best to invest timing and resources to make them successful in that 90-day period. And then we talk about the function that they will have for the next 2 years, and then create, hopefully, the growth pattern if the individual expresses interest. Some people are content with the position based on other requirements that they may have personally, but we try to meet the need of the individual.
90 days.
That's not easy. No, and it isn't easy, and I don't think anybody has one particular template that's going to address the needs for everyone, but that's why we're interested in partnering with the other businesses in our community, because they may have the skill sets that we don't. We're just trying to make the connection. We're trying to build a group and inspire the interest together. And we're not going to say that we have the know-how to do it all, but we think we can tap into finding that expertise to hopefully meet the needs of the school community.
So am I hearing you correctly that you don't have an education minimum education degree? You have competencies.
Yeah, we have a high school requirement. We do have individuals that have completed their GED, though, with our organization if we thought they had the potential.
Interesting. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming tonight. And
thank you. you. I hope we contribute a little bit.
Yes, and we hope to continue these discussions. Next from the business community, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, we have Bill Blazar. Blazar? Senior Vice President, Public Affairs and Business Development for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the committee.
You always wonder when you push that button if anything's going to happen. So let me just... There we go. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Blazer. Indicated I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I think this is a great topic, and maybe more for personal reasons than others. My youngest son just graduated from high school last year, so I've just gone through the junior and senior year, and I think he did just fine. I think there is probably some opportunities here for some changes and to tune things up a little bit. So the state chamber represents about 2,400 businesses around the state. The most interesting thing about our membership is that if you cut it geographically or if you cut it by industry or by size of company, it pretty much looks like the state's economy. So we're, in many respects, kind of a microcosm of the whole. What I'm going to do quickly is I'm going to give you two takes on how businesses think the state is doing in preparing the workforce for the state's economy. I think both of these takes, if you will, suggest that the current system needs some changes, and both of them also suggest that the systems need to be more flexible, both as to content and as to methodology. Now, the first one is going to be a poll that we just completed this summer, and I'll get to that in a second. The second take comes from a series of visits that we've done with businesses through our Grow Minnesota program, and I'll come to that in a minute as well. And I'll warn you from the beginning that these two takes may not be entirely consistent. In fact, every time I think about them, I can find some contradictions. So all I want to try and do is give you a couple of sort of two examples or two samplings of what business people are thinking about how we prepare the workforce. And I think it will help you as you get to the point of making recommendations. And even though there are these kind of inconsistencies and maybe even some contradictions, I think both do suggest the need for change, and even I think you'll see some potential redesign strategies in the comments of some of these companies. So with that, let me take you through this poll, which talks about a lot of issues, but the most important thing to start out is it meets all of the tests of reliability and validity. It's a good reflection of the chamber's member businesses. And just as a little bit of a kind of a warm-up here, we asked these companies what the most important issue is to their business. And I show you this not because I don't want to discourage you from your task, because you'll see that workforce and K-12 funding kind of come after taxes, that's no surprise, transportation and healthcare. But the key thing, I think, is from our perspective, when we talk to businesses, they take that workforce and that K-12 funding column, and that's kind of one big ball to them. Very few companies make the distinction between the K-12 system and the higher ed system, and for that matter, the kind of workforce development programs that are run through DEED. So for my purposes, I take those two and put them together and call it 38% and say that it's a wash with the others. So it's a big deal, and I don't have any reservation about saying that. I think the one of the reasons that the companies are concerned is that, you know, they're competing in this global market, and they're measuring the potential employees who come to them against their competitors. And their competitors are more likely to be outside the U.S. than in the U.S. And you can see here how we do. The rankings aren't bad, but relative to some of the Southeast Asian companies in math and science, you know, there's some work to do. And even nationally, and I think you probably have seen these statistics before, we do better. Our ACT scores rank number one in the country, and that's something that we should all take pride in. But that last bullet point, that only 31% met all of the ACT's definition of college readiness, I think that's significant. Now, I show you these two slides just to give you some sense of how this problem kind of rises on the business equation, or in terms of business math of issues. So we asked the companies, and here's some specific responses. We asked them, do you, as a part of your budget, take time and money to train your workers? And this should be of no surprise to anybody. 86% of them said, yep, we spend money on both, we spend both money and time training somebody who comes to work for us. So we asked them, well, what's the trend in what you're spending over the last 2 years? Are you spending more or less about the same? And here you'll see that 56% say they're spending more, and another 40% about the same. And we've asked this question for about 4 years now, and the percent that say they're spending more goes up. But going back to this other, the commitment to time and money for training, most of the employers that I talk to, when they hire somebody, they always plan on doing some training. I visited with a manufacturer in Alexandria who has a big welding operation, and the first thing that he wanted to tell me was that nobody in North America, or for that matter the world, welds the way he welds. So they could have all the training in the world. When you come to work here, I'm going to teach you how to weld. This guy had 12 employees, and he's a great welder, but you know, there's only one way to do it, and that's his way. Now, that may be another problem, but okay, so they train, they spend money on it. So why they spend on training, and here you see the point, 82% say it's mostly because they want to make sure that the worker has the skills that are unique to their company. But what I want to call your attention to is that 15% where they say that they're training also on skills that, in their judgment anyway, should have been taught in high school or post-secondary schools. And when you kind of probe that 15%, you find that their concern, when these companies report on what they are training and when they think they're making up for what somebody else should have done, more often than not, they say they're making up for what went on in high school. So they're actually talking about pretty basic reading and math scores. The other higher ed institutions work their way in there as well, but the K-12 concern is far greater, so, and I'll come back to that other slide in a minute. But we had an open-ended question in this poll because we as an organization are struggling with how to take this big ball of stuff called education and workforce development and sort of figure out strategically where we ought to work. So in the poll, we said to the participants, tell us what you think we ought to do to fix the education system, where we ought to focus our activities. I call your attention to the third bullet point. We got 269 people to write us a response. Only 5 of them mentioned higher education. The other 264 were all about K-12 and largely about high school. So I thought that's pretty amazing. Now, if you look at kind of what they suggested, understand these are business people who are busy and they're not experts on education. You're getting kind of a gut reaction from them. I think, though, that when the second point when they talk about rewarding teachers and removing tenure, I think the tenure thing is all about flexibility. They're looking for an education system that is more adaptive to this very changing economy. And the rewarding teacher thing, we tested some potential reforms to the K-12 system. We didn't focus on high school, but we tested some potential reforms. And what's interesting here is that pay for performance comes up big time. And to go back to, or big time relative to these others, go back to Representative Benson's question a little bit ago, it is somehow we have to motivate people or do a better job of motivating teachers to stick with the profession, and it may be, I think, to a great extent it's about money. That is a very powerful motivating force. But I think there's always going to be a part of work is, do you like to go to work in the morning? So pay for performance, at least in terms of these businesses, is something we ought to be thinking about and trying. But we also need to make sure that people who are teaching really want to go to work in the morning. And you put those two things together, and I think people will stay. I call your attention to year-round schooling. When you sample the general business community, there isn't nearly as much interest in year-round schooling as there is among our members. And I think what that is that's just a bunch of Minnesota Chamber members thinking we need to be really different. We really do need a new model. And so they're more willing and maybe a little more adventuresome in terms of trying something different. The notion of a voucher or a tax credit, there I think that reflects their desire for the system to be more flexible, and they're reflecting on their experience within their company. Their customers have all kinds of choices. If they're not delivering what the customer needs, the customer goes elsewhere. And I think they're kind of laying that same concept onto the education system. Right or wrong, you can reject these strategies, but I think what you're seeing is a willingness and a desire for the system to be more flexible and to be willing to try some different things to meet the needs, at least of the business community. Okay, with that, let me shift gears to Grow Minnesota, which is the visits with companies, and just to show you a couple things there, and then I'll stop. Grow Minnesota is the Chamber, Minnesota Chamber, and 40 local chambers of commerce business retention program. I call it Eyes and Ears on Minnesota's Economy. Last year, it was 797 one-on-one visits between a local business leader and the owner or manager of one of these companies. So it's a conversation between two peers. We did these conversations in almost 50 communities, and I want to say from the beginning, this is not, unlike the poll that I just showed you, this is not a random sample. Each of these local chambers and the Minnesota Chamber picked the companies that they wanted to go visit. Now, they saw a lot of companies, and these visits were done through September of 2006. We did a whole nother round of 800 visits this year, but we haven't totaled up those results. I can give those to you later. So this data is a little bit old, but it's a lot of conversations, and you can see they're pretty well scattered around the state. We don't have as many in northwestern Minnesota as we'd like to have, but the rest of the state is pretty well represented. You can see the distribution by region. The Twin Cities is as the kind of major part of the state's economy, is very well represented. All businesses of all sizes, but we talked to a lot of small companies. 0 to 50 is by far the dominant size company that we visited with. A lot of positive things come out of these conversations, and this is, 52% of these companies said they're going to add jobs. This last year, that number is dropping. I think we're seeing some weakness in the economy. And importantly, 70% of these companies say that they will add a new good or service within the next 2 years. So they're innovating, and they're innovating rapidly. And then the most exciting thing is these companies, even the tiny ones, are working hard to sell their good or service outside of Minnesota. By exporting, they mean having customers out elsewhere in the U.S. or around the world. Okay, so when you ask them in the conversation, what do you worry about? What is going to hold you back in terms of growing? The most common response, these are in order, is our workforce issues. Can we find workers with the right skills? We hear it statewide, but interestingly, and I can speculate later why, we hear it somewhat more frequently in greater Minnesota. So these companies, they all have plans to grow. They're all thinking about what they need to do to grow. And they agree, one of the things that really makes them nervous is, can they find the people? So let's explore that a little bit. The growth that we saw in these companies was pretty strong. I think we'll see some weakness this year. Most of these companies, when they're looking for a worker, they're not looking for 100 of them. Typically, they're looking for 2 or 4 or maybe 1. And almost 70% of us tell us that when they post the opening, they're really difficult to fill. So almost two-thirds of these companies say, you know, it's hard to fill the jobs when they're open. And I like to show this slide. This is just from the state demographer. This problem of looking for people, that 70% are hard to fill, as I'm sure the demographer, Mr. Gillespie, told you last time, this is only going to get worse. And all I did here was plot the growth in the workforce between now and 2030. And it grows, but it grows at a slower rate. So if we're having trouble finding people now, it only gets worse. And the sad thing is that a lot of these companies have really good plans and good prospects for growth, but if they can't find the people, that's a problem. Okay, so now what are they looking for? And I think this is maybe more to your task here. Generally speaking, it's the right skills. The output of these companies has become more complicated and more specialized. And that's true whether I'm talking to a manufacturer or a company that produces a service. We've got a company that made parts 10 years ago, like a lot of screws, today is making an assembly. You take a company like Team Industries, which is headquartered in Bagley. They do a lot of work for the snowmobile industry. When they started out, they were making some of the castings and moldings for the clutch that's in a snowmobile. Today, they make the whole clutch. It's more complicated. It's more sophisticated. Secondly, many more of these companies are in the made-to-order business. They're not making thousands of much of anything. They might make one. That's not unusual. There's look at the packaging companies in Alexandria. Those companies, there are seven of them. I think there's seven of them. When they make a packaging device, it's made to order. They will make one or two, whatever. You know, General Mills introduces a new product, a new package for yogurt, for example. They need a machine to handle that new package, to put it in a case so it can be shipped. They don't make very many of them, so it's very much made to order. And the same thing is true with the service businesses. If you even look at something like telemarketing, there are fewer and fewer general telemarketing firms. They specialize. I got a new Dodge Caravan a couple years ago. 3 days after I got it, I got a phone call from a company saying, well, do you like the car? I said, yeah, it's terrific. I've had it 3 days. What do I know? They said, well, have you read the manual? And of course I haven't. They said, well, if you ever have any questions, just give us a call. It turns out that the company making that call is based in Minnesota. And their specialty is working for car manufacturers. All of their people have not only read the manual, they understand it backwards and forwards, and they can answer questions, and that's what they do, because they're trying to build my brand loyalty to Dodge in this case. The other piece, so right skills, that's a much more challenging part of the equation than it's ever been, especially in Minnesota. And then you throw in the fact that the rate of innovation, at least among the companies that we're visiting with, it tends to be accelerating, and I think this issue of the right skills becomes a lot more of a challenge, especially when you figure that we have a slowly growing workforce. So what kind of jobs are most difficult to fill? You'll see specialty skills. That's any kind of production worker. Those are a rare commodity statewide. But you can also see management, sales, and marketing jobs. Those are tough, too. I did a comparison here between the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota. You can see that the specialty skills are particularly difficult to find in Greater Minnesota. Same with management. On the other hand, you come to the Twin Cities and the sales and marketing jobs are more difficult to fill. But this trend, what you're seeing here, as far as we can tell, is just going to continue as the rate of growth in the workforce slows. Okay, so the workforce challenges. The idea here is to supply workers for a growing economy, and the key thing that you ought to think about is you think about retooling high school, or for that matter, the parts of the higher ed system, is the characteristics of the economy, and that is that you've got lots of small participants. When you think about redesigning high school, I'm not sure it's a great idea to think about Fortune 500 companies and what they need. I know it's harder, but it's probably better to think about the guy with, or the business with, say, 8 or 10 employees. Secondly, these companies that you're trying to help, they're all over the state, and it's a big state, so you've got a geographic dispersion problem. And third, these companies are thriving on innovation. So what you train somebody to do today, you may not need them to do it tomorrow. So when we think about resources, we think about the higher ed system, but I think those last 2 years of high school are prime opportunities. And then finally, I think the employers have some obligation and responsibility in this training system. They clearly are training now, and there's no reason to expect that they will do any less. So just in terms of concluding here, you know, what do we do? We need to, and I think I'm serious about this, we need to create workers. And the way we create workers is when we think about redesigning that high school program or the higher ed system, we really do need to focus on unemployed and underemployed individuals. We have untapped resources in people who are not working or who are out of the workforce. When you think about redesigning, I would have that as a target. Secondly, we need to work really hard on building the foundation skills because that you can't be versatile unless you've got certain basics like reading and writing and those fundamentals. And then this I hear often from employers, and that is that the notion, teach the basics or give students the basics of a profession quickly. Employers increasingly are not interested in somebody graduating from high school and then, let's say, going to a technical college or a community college for 2 years or 3 years and then coming into the workforce. What they're finding is that for somebody who might have had some trouble in high school, is that period away from the workforce is just too long. So, and employers are experimenting with this right now. They will go to the high school in their community, fund a welding program, hire as interns the students in that program during the summer, and those that work out, they'll offer a job to as soon as they graduate. And the employer's intention is not for this student not to pursue higher education. It's quite the contrary. What the employer wants is to get that young adult into their workplace, get them used to coming to work on time, working a full day, knowing how to dress appropriately. And then as quick as that's established, they want that worker enrolled in either the technical school or the community college because they want the skill levels to develop along with it. But that's kind of a foreign concept because our model is 4 years of high school and then 2 years of a technical school or a community college or a four-year undergraduate degree. We kind of separate the end of high school with the beginning of work by a period of time. And then fourth and finally, some kind of after-employment training because these skills, as this economy evolves and changes very rapidly, we're all going to need to retool over and over again, and somehow we need to establish that habit. The employer role, my guess is you'll see more and more employers not only offering but being willing to have on-the-job training programs and internships on their premises, because I think they're starting to see that that's part of the equation for having a pool of potential employees when they want to expand. And that's the big challenge. So if you bring these two things together, I think there is a real audience out there for a fairly substantial redesign of whether it's high school or those first years of higher ed, and that it's really got to revolve around flexibility, and flexibility both as to content and as to methodology, because what we're discovering is that one approach to teaching children, or teaching young adults, I should say, a profession or the basics just doesn't work anymore. So that, I guess the word I'd leave you with is flexibility. We need to get it into the system, particularly in the high school, and the sooner the better. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Very interesting question. Yes. Representative Tilbury.
Yes, Bill, I'm glad that you're here tonight and joining us with the discussion. But I look at some of the things that that I've even seen on one of the committees that I worked with, which was the tax committee. And when I saw the chamber, the only time I really saw the chamber come to the table was when they wanted lower taxes. And that's all we ever heard. And so when I look at that, I think of the no-tax people in the Chamber of Commerce. But then if you go back to one of your slides that you had five or six, I don't know, because you could go back to one of those slides that that you had listed. Keep going. Right there. Move it forward one.
Sure.
Okay. All of this, you know, we could probably agree on and look into that direction. But if you were also talking about performance pay for teachers and so on, the system of performance pay would probably cost more than it does now.
Yeah.
Okay? So in that, if you take that into consideration, it doesn't make sense to have that third one to be the one thing that comes clear with the chamber. And that's my opinion of how it, you know, my perception of what I've seen.
Sure.
And so it seems like it contradicts. And that's why I'm really glad that you're here, because I want to know more of how they're thinking, because I want to have workers help businesses so we can all get to the same spot at the end. But, you know, if I look at the way it's been described, business is basically telling teachers what they should be paid or how they should be paid without really being there at the end with them. And that's kind of where it's not necessarily a question, it's more of a statement. I guess you can react to that if you'd like.
Madam Chair, Representative, let me respond. I think there is, I think businesses are, their general view, as you could see at the beginning of this thing, when we asked them kind of their number one concern, you know, the taxes are a concern because these companies know that they're in a global market, they know that their expenses go up, that jeopardizes their entire operation. So I don't want to in any way shortchange or let you feel that, you know, that they don't have a real concern about any kind of increase in taxes. But for a second, I'll take you to transportation. Transportation, the state chamber, we've supported a 5-cent fuel tax increase. That's a tax increase. And when we visit with our members about that, they see a pretty clear correlation between paying more and what they're going to get at the end. So now to come back to education and to the system of compensation, and I've visited with local chambers where their community is going to have a referendum levy this fall, and our advice to them is to sit down with the school district and to, in a way, think about education the way you've thought about transportation. talk to the school district about what investment am I making here? If we support a tax increase, you, superintendent or school board members or whoever we're visiting with, tell us what your goals are with respect to the outcomes for the students over the next 5 or 10 years of the life of the referendum. Just tell us what we're buying. Because I don't think you'll get businesses to support whether it's higher taxes or buying more widgets for their company unless they know the proposition and the value proposition. And with respect to education, I don't think that we've done a very good job, at least in terms of business people, of defining that value proposition. And because of it, the instincts of the business community are to say to whether it's the K-12 system or other, is to, you got this significant amount of resources, let's figure out first if we can't make them go further. So, for example, we've supported reallocating resources for the QCOM system, which may not be perfect in terms of changing the compensation system to reward results, but it's a start in that direction. And we know that if we're taking a finite amount of resources and reallocating some, that there's going to be some pinch elsewhere. But we think that changing the compensation system is so important that it's worth doing that. Now, in terms of adding new resources to that system, there I get back to the value proposition. I don't think that proposition has been made clearly to businesses, be it at the state or the local level.
Mr. Representative Benson.
Thank you. I agree with a lot of the things you said. I remember thinking about the salary schedule that I labored under all those years. I used to call it deferred compensation system because when I started teaching, my yearly salary was $5,000 a year. And I taught economics for a number of those years, and when one factored in inflation, my buying power went up almost exactly $100 a year in 3 or 4 years. And I'd ask you the same question, and I just don't see how we're going to find people staying in the profession with that kind of compensation. But I do agree with you that unless we can show value for the dollar, the society is not going to make the necessary investments. That is true. I would say probably that superintendent might respond to you by saying, well, if you help us pass the bond issue, we'll try real hard to keep Minnesota number one in the nation with ACT, but we're not going to catch up to Singapore.
Madam Chair, Representative, when I started teaching, I got $4,000 a year. So,
probably one of my seniors.
Right. So, and it was an issue then, and it's an issue now.
Yeah.
I don't know that responding by kind of, well, I think what the business community isn't looking, they're not looking for a universal response. And we don't want to suggest necessarily what the goal should be because we're not the professional educators.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like a superintendent to think about the nature of the student population and who he's got to work with or she's got to work with this year and say, you know, given the resources that we have and given the nature of the student body, our goal for the next 5 years is going to be to raise the math score so much and the reading score so much, and that's the value proposition. You guys support this referendum, and we're going to do our best to achieve that goal. And I think most businesses would consider that pretty reasonable. And the progress toward that goal or any kind of shortfalling, those ought to be positive conversations. It's not the business community doesn't want to set a goal in order to be punitive. We want to set a goal so we know where we're going so we can all get together and try and work to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Blazer. I have to reiterate what Representative Tilbury said, is that I think this conversation is extremely valuable. I think that we are not that far apart in what we want, and the more we talk, I think we are less far apart on even how to get there. I really do think so. And I just find this very, very, very interesting conversation back and forth. And I thank you very much for coming here tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, and I hope we can continue these discussions. Thank you. And meeting is adjourned.